You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello, folks, and welcome to PyReps. PyReps is a show dedicated to educating, informing, and piquing the interests of the flying public, student pilots, new private pilots, and anyone interested in the world of general and commercial aviation. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of PyReps. I'm Private Pilot Phil, and with me is First Officer Brian Johnson. Hello, Brian.
How's it going, Phil?
Also with me tonight is Line Service Technician Alex. Hi, Alex.
How's it going, Mr. Phil?
And Ground Instructor Bazzy.
Hello, hello, I'm back.
The infamous Ground Instructor Bazzy.
I shouldn't be back, but I guess for the viewers, I'm back. It's all good.
I'm sure that's why you're here.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Today's episode is called The Importance of Airport Ground Operations, and we have Line Service Technician Alex with us, and we're going to start talking to you.
Oh, boy.
And you're going to have the floor.
Oh, boy.
He's in the hot seat today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're in the hot seat.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
So first, the first thing we're going to ask you is, what does a Line Service Technician do?
So my job description, as I've always put it, is I move airplanes, fuel airplanes, and brown nose the multimillionaires. I base essentially on a, whether it's a large commercial or small airport, I am moving aircraft. When they come in, I'm guiding them in, giving them services, that's whether that's fueling, taking care of the labs, wiping the windows, sometimes I vacuum interiors. But the essence is I am maneuvering parking aircraft. If they need to be moved anywhere on the field, I move them. And then I fuel them for refueling purposes.
Sounds like a fun job, but a tough one.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we talked a little bit about, since you know, they're going to be coming in, you know, we're taxiing in, hand signals. And
yes.
We talk about the batons. You know, a lot of, when I was in flight school, I was never taught the signals.
Yeah.
Because I hardly ever ran into somebody with the, so I had to guess.
Yeah.
When I would taxi in someplace, and here's the guy with the baton, I had to guess what he was telling.
Oh, yeah.
I was right, but I mean,
yeah,
go ahead and explain that.
So there's actually a good 2-3 dozen different hang signals, depending on whether it's fixed wing or rotor, like helicopters. There's different ones for helicopters. I won't get into that. But there's some generic ones. I wish I had the website. I couldn't find the website, but you can look them up on YouTube or Google. The few general ones is, I'll have one hand down pointing to the ground and one hand up in the air. That's, I'm telling you, I want your nose right here and I'm going to face it. I'm going to be facing you. And then as you're coming towards me, I'll have my hand stretched out and coming in towards my body. That's come towards me. And then either I can have the left hand out and the right one coming towards me. That is turn to your right. And then have my right hand out and my left one coming towards me. That's you turn left. And those are really the important ones. That's all right. You really know is that way I'm guiding you, parking you. Normally, if it's the ramp, a ramp is not crowded, you don't need to worry about the direction ones. I'm just going to tell you, nose here, park, you're good. We're done.
Okay.
But it's critical that people pay attention to that. Like I'm waving, like trying to get your attention. I'm waving and I'm pointing at you. You know, hello, I'm over here. Look at me. And a lot of GA guys tend to kind of ignore. I get a lot of them that do that to me. They'll completely ignore me.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
You think it's because they're not expecting to see you there or?
I don't know if it's their.
They just have an intent.
I think they just have their own intent. They know what they're doing because they're the pilot. But when you're going, and I think a lot of guys too, especially where I work, a lot of people are used to the non-controlled airports where they do just taxi onto a terminal ramp and it's. Okay, I park here, I'm good, whatever. But if you go into the larger commercial ones or the smaller ones that I work at that don't have airlines, we have to control stuff. We have to know what's going on because we have jets showing up randomly, Gulfstreams
right.
And Citations. And so it's important to pay attention when we're out there to us.
Okay, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you, do you think that – and we just touched on this a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think flight schools – should do maybe a better job of training students about hand signals?
I don't know if it's that they need to be trained, but they should understand and know some of the basic ones. Like when they're out doing their pre-inspection, they see one of us out, you know, a line guy out. Maybe the instructor should take the initiative and go, hey, let's talk with this line guy real quick and learn about some of the hand signals. Like if you're going to a controlled field and then a controlled FBO, you know, what to expect. And there's not a super lot you need to know about it. Just the big thing is pay attention. And if I can tell, like I'm usually good at telling when people don't know what I'm saying, I'll just point my nose and point at the ground and they can figure it out from there.
Oh, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we also discussed chalking airplanes.
Yeah.
Tell us why we want to chalk airplanes. And I know it's the pilot's responsibility, but why do we chalk airplanes and who's responsible?
So whether you're a student, instructor, or the plane owner, you are responsible for ensuring your aircraft is chalked. That being said, for instance, where I work, part of my responsibility is to actually come out to your aircraft, chalk you, and check on you and see if you need anything, any services, fuel, whatever. But that you should still always ensure that if maybe I'm not around, maybe it's a slow day and I'm out busy and you just come on my ramp and park, almost every FBO has chalks laying around somewhere. You should always chalk your aircraft. And the reason you chalk them, whether you have a parking brake or not, you don't want that aircraft to be taken by a wind. And if it's not a windy day, well, maybe a jet's going to come in, and jet blast is a very serious thing that can whip and move aircraft. Or you're going to get a kamikaze helicopter pilot come in and go right over top it. And they do.
Yep.
And you watch these Cessnas bounce on 150s. I mean, I've seen them almost go up in the air from a helicopter going too close over top it. I'm like, you guys got to make sure you're paying attention that it's chalked.
Let's go back a minute. Let's start at the beginning, because some of the student pilots that are listening might not know what a chalk is. And we're not talking about a piece of chalk to write on side of the airplane.
Correct.
Go ahead and explain.
It's
C-H-O-C-K.
Yeah, C-H-O-C-K. Yeah. So it's a chalk, which should be two pieces of either wood or rubber that may or may not have a reflective strip and that may or may not have tape on them, but they should be roped together. And they're usually a triangle shape. And one flat end is going to lay on the ground. The other flat is going to go up against the tire. And then the rope connects around the other tire, the other side of the tire, and butts up to it. So that way the aircraft is, essentially the wheel can't move unless you move the chalks.
Okay.
And with a lot of aircraft, you typically want to chalk a main. Not always. It depends. Like if, for instance, if you get to Cirrus aircraft, because they have the free casting nose, you want to chalk a main, but you also have to chalk a nose, because that free caster wheel can just whip that. I mean, those airplanes can whip around and they get caught in the right wind. I've had those things get away from people not being chalked in the winds.
Right.
Cirrus doesn't want to fly. That's a great thing about those airplanes.
Yes.
It's not a great thing when they're on the ground and you've got 20 knot plus winds hitting them and they all of a sudden just turn into the wind and start following, moving by themselves because people didn't chalk them. I've had it happen three times. All three times were Sears craft.
I just want to say, like, the one thing about what Alex was talking about is also part of, after you finish every flight, part of securing your aircraft is, you know, that is chalking, making sure the windows, seat belts, all those things, we stress on that as far as from a school to get the students to, you know, start doing it, taking responsibility, and that is part of your securing the aircraft checklist.
Absolutely.
So take that as, okay, not when I just land and then I get out, I'm done. No, you're still, that airplane is still under your, if you want to say your command or however, until you complete that securing the aircraft checklist, until the other person takes the keys or takes the checklist, the airplane is still your responsibility.
Yeah.
And it is your responsibility to go ahead and chalk the airplane, secure it from all, you know, just as if you bring it back and put it as if you took it, basically. That's what we try to tell students.
And if you can't find chalks, you know, find a line service guy and say, hey, I couldn't find chalks, chalk my airplane, just letting you know. And we, like, whether it's me or if you're going to any other airport, someone will find chalks and they'll chalk your airplane for you, as long as we know. But if you get to a busy day, busy times, you know, things can get lost. You don't know what's going on. So it's always good to ask someone and find out.
Absolutely.
Always ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've done that once or twice.
Yeah.
Not really thinking, you know. What about tie downs? Now, I know, like, I've rented from places that you actually have to tie the airplane down once you're done. What's the difference between chalking and tie down, and which is more effective?
So essentially, all the chalk's doing is securing the wheels. That's all you're doing.
Okay.
Tie down secures the whole aircraft. You're tying down both the wing roots. There's going to be a hook eyelet or some type of hook. Yeah, hook eyelet. Whether it's at the base of the strut or under the wings for a low wing and at the tail. And there should be 3 points. And you tie it down, secure it. So that way, whether you've got the severe winds that the aircraft, that chalk might not always be enough. Or you're an area where a lot of jets turn and whip and they jet blast aircraft parked. That's just more safety for the pilot in their mind. That way they know their aircraft is tied down, it's secure. They shouldn't have to worry about it getting away, doing anything, blowing away. It's content. Yeah.
Fascinating. And First Officer Brian Johnson, you're welcome to jump in anytime.
You're welcome anytime to contradict me and say that I'm don't know what I'm talking about.
No, you're absolutely. It's even important in the airlines too.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned the hand signals. The larger aircraft that I fly for work are so big, so where when you look out the back window from the cockpit, you can't see the wingtips or the tail.
Yeah.
So you absolutely need a crew of people.
Yep.
At least one marshaler in front of you, and preferably two wing walkers, one on each wingtip, to guide you in. Because I can't see when we're parking how far out my wingtip is to the left and to the right. So I can't see whether or not I'm going to hit something.
Yep.
So it's very important that we're all on the same page as far as hand signals are concerned. So we know they're telling us, like you said, to move straight ahead or left or right, or to speed up or slow down or stop. We need to be on the same page with all those hand signals when the chocks are in.
Yep.
Because again, we don't want to open the main cabin door until the airplane's chocked.
Yep.
Because if we open that main cabin door and start letting passengers deplane and the chocks aren't in, and that airplane starts rolling, we've got a problem on our hands, people don't give ground crews enough credit. It is a very, very important.
And that's an issue where we run into not only with the large jets like you're flying, but when we get the aircraft that the doors come down and rest on the ground, like the Challengers, and sometimes the Lear jets where they have the little extra T-handle for the door.
Yeah.
And if the airplane decides to roll, I mean, there was a Challenger that came in, they put it down, and the person didn't put the chocks right up against the tires. And so guess what? They released their brakes, and it rolled.
Oh.
And that could have damaged it. They were very lucky that it just glided on there. It was fine. But that could still – I mean, if that little pin that comes down that touches the ground for the door got caught in a crack and it shifted – I mean, that tweaks the door. That could tweak the airframe.
Mm-hmm.
Goodbye. you're done.
Who knows what kind of stress fractures.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Plus a lot of money down the line for repairs or anything.
Yep. Yeah.
So we're going to talk about moving aircraft.
Yeah.
We talked briefly on that.
Mm-hmm.
And you were kind of unique in explaining to me how you hangar aircraft, especially from the time the hangar is empty until you get filled up. There's a certain technique and a way you guys do that. Explain that to us.
So when I do a lot of hangar stacking stuff, I don't do it as much as I used to, but we used to dump entire hangars. You know, I can't remember the square footage, but we would be stuffing Hawkers, Challengers into these hangars, Gulfstreams. So, you know, you've got about 6-7 big jets plus a couple smaller ones. And my rule of thumb always was I wanted the bigger jets in the back, the biggest in the back, because that's where you have the most maneuverability, most room. When you're fighting hangar doors, there's no such – I've never seen a hangar that the doors were all the way to for the wall size. They all – they always stick out. And the closer you are to the doors, the harder it is to maneuver aircraft. So when I'm doing that stuff, I'm always being very cautious and trying to get them in. And you want to leave when you're stacking side by side and locking wings and noses and stuff. My rule of thumb, what I do is I want to be able – when I walk around the aircraft, I want to be able to do the chicken dance, not the shuffle.
Right.
So if I walk between aircraft, I should be able to have my arms out going like a chicken and walk around the whole aircraft. If I have to – maneuver and shift around and do the shuffle to get around the aircraft. No, can't do that because you never know if something's going to happen. I mean, maybe there was a wet spot where you put your chocks and didn't realize it of jet fuel, and that chock shoots out and the aircraft shifts, or maybe a landing gear collapses, like the strut, not the gear itself, but the strut. I've had that happen where a strut collapses.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden, well, now the aircraft's shifted and moved. One wing goes down, one wing comes up. So you have to make sure you don't have, you know, maybe that Lear wing was a little under that Hawker nose, and now it just came up. Did it strike? Did it do something?
Right.
So you got to be very cautious about how you're stacking these airplanes and moving them around. And that, and that's the same goes for all the small aircraft, GA guys,
sure.
little Pipers, little Cessnas, it all matters there too. Cause even if your non-retractable gear or the solid gear, like the Cessnas have, I mean, a tire goes flat. Okay. It's going to shift the whole aircraft. It will.
Absolutely.
And then you have mm-hmm. to, you have to consider the maintenance guy has come in and jack it up and we do stuff. Well, it's again, it shifts now the other way. So you always got to make sure you're paying attention to how that's done.
So it's a delicate balance.
Yes. It's much. It's a lot of guessing and trial and error. I've had to multiple when we moved recently, but our old facility, I had to constantly put an aircraft in carefully, then put another aircraft in and look at it, stand back and go, I don't like that. Pull one back out and put a different aircraft in and just be very cautious and very slow because you want to move aircraft as minimal as possible. You don't want to keep moving them.
It's almost like you're measuring.
Right.
Right.
Right. A lot of places will have a little to scaled hangar with scaled aircraft. Well, we're not fancy enough to have that. So it's kind of it's a gambit where I have a couple spotters with me and we're trying to see how aircraft fit together.
Okay.
So I'm a lot better with that now. I know how a lot of aircraft stack. I don't have to do back and forth thing. But when early on, when you're learning, I was always told you want to move as little as possible. Every time you move, that's a risk of damaging the aircraft.
Absolutely.
But unless you do it, you don't know. You don't see and visualize. So you kind of want to, if you have the chance, if you can go, hey, this guy's not busy, spot me, play around and move the aircraft to see how they fit together and what they're doing and figure it out. It's because it's all visual. It's all visual for that.
Okay. Explain what a spotter is real quick.
So a spotter is an individual that will be assisting you when you're moving the aircraft. So back up a little bit. When I'm on a tug, the vehicle that moves the aircraft, it's a tug, tractor, whatever. I am on the front hooked at the nose of the aircraft and I am facing the aircraft. So I'm actually, if I'm putting the aircraft in, I am pushing it. I am facing the aircraft as I'm pushing it. And so I will have someone on – most places require three spotters, one on each wingtip and one at the tail.
Okay.
And that's great, but the times I've seen incidents happen is when there's multiple spotters like that, because when I am moving the aircraft, I am focusing on four points is wingtip, tail tip, wingtip.
Okay.
And some aircraft, if you've got the lower horizontal, then you've got technically five. You've also got the top of the vertical. So that's
right.
5 points you're paying attention to because those are the farthest out points of the aircraft. And I want to make sure that nothing's going to strike. So if you've got a person on each wingtip and a person on the tail telling you stuff while you're also watching and looking yourself, because I don't always trust the spotter. I really should. But I'm the one moving this multi-million-dollar aircraft.
That's true.
So I'm the one that's focusing and paying attention. So I got people yelling at me or blowing whistles, and it's like, no, I don't like I like having one spotter. So what I'll do is I have them spotting me general sense. They'll go wingtip to wingtip, walk it, and I'll take my time. And then as you get close to things, whether it's a wall, another aircraft, a vehicle in the hangar, then you take it slow and you stop. You let them walk around. They give me the thumb up, and I'll move another couple feet and stop. They'll walk around, give me another thumb up. And that way I know I'm also able to watch the aircraft, all the points, and watch this guy give me – because you can't always see the back of the aircraft, just like you're a pilot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You can't see all around the aircraft, like you were saying, Brian.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing moving them. So I can't always see the best part of the tail. Hawkers are very deceiving because that tail slants back, and then there's the horizontals there. It's very deceiving. I can't tell always. So it's good to have someone back there spotting me, you know, saying, keep coming, you know, a foot. And they're giving me hand signals, putting their hands up like 3 feet, 2 feet, 1 feet, and then I know.
Mm-hmm. Then you can just stop it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we make good use of that in the airline world also.
Yeah.
I mean, what a lot of passengers don't know is when we stop the plane and you deplane while we're turning the plane around and getting it ready for the next flight, we've got caterers coming in to restock the galley carts. We've got the fuel truck coming in to refuel us. We've got maybe a lav service truck to come in to service the lavatories. And you'll watch it. I'll go out and I'll do my pre-flight walk-around inspection, and you'll see the catering truck come up. And you'll see a person hop out of the passenger seat.
Yep.
And you'll see them actually, as the catering truck backs up next to the airplane, spot the driver so that they know how far to back up so that they're not going to hit the airplane.
Oh, yeah.
Same with the lab trucks, same with the fuel trucks. It's very important.
I don't remember.
Very delicate.
I don't remember the exact number, but it's like 85 or 80% of aircraft strike issues are on the ground and the aircraft's not even moving. It's mm-hmm. always service vehicles running into them or when they're tugging and moving them and they run into something.
Yeah, I would believe it's, it.
Yeah, yep. that's when it almost always happens.
And also, like, when you're – I've helped spot before. And when you're spotting for somebody, as Alex was saying, it's also – the tug is also loud as well. So it's important that – you communicate, and it people don't realize how much effort it actually takes to put an aircraft in the hangar, take it out, and you feel a sense of responsibility. It's like even if I'm spotting the airplane, he's moving, but I'm spotting, I feel a sense of huge responsibility on my shoulders. Going, I hope I get this right. And usually, so take your time, and it's important for people to realize that ground crews, like we said, are really very important. To the aspect of every flight when it comes to operations and aviation. And I just feel that as I've spotted before, the more I started helping out at the airport, you know, spotting and stuff like that. And it really, you have a sense of appreciation for what these guys do. And it's really kind of cool to see, like Brian said, it's interesting.
Yeah. It's, well said. And like you said, it's a combination of hand and vocal. Yeah. And I want you to be loud. I mean, I'm going, you know, cause like when we stack our hangars, I'm people and the maintenance guys laugh at me when I'm doing this because I'm very loud and I'm saying, you know, tail really good, you know, and I walk around wingtip good, left wing good, helicopter good. And I'm because I know the guy in the tug, what he is seeing and what he can't see. So I'm shouting things so he understands and he knows because maybe that left wing, he thinks he might be getting close to that helicopter. Well, I'll yell helicopter good. And he goes, okay, it's not a big deal. I can get around it. And it's that, you know, looking for thumbs up with people for spying. Right. And that's the thing going
we
back.
We have to also trust that person too.
Yeah. And that's like when say you taxi in your 172 and park, your parked or whatever, and also another guy comes in another airplane. Well, I mean, remember that's your airplane. So you should step up to that wingtip and see that, make eyes with the other pilot and give him a thumbs up and let him when he swings in so he knows he's not going to hit your aircraft.
Right.
And I do see pilots do it, which is good. But a lot of times people just walk away from the airplane and then maybe I'm busy. Maybe something's going on. So you should be self-aware of your own aircraft. You know it's busy and stuff's going on. And we also implement traffic cones essentially for right. like wingtips or tails or whatever. So if we know it's a busy day and people are taxiing, the cone is a lot easier representation because the cone sits typically 1-2 feet away from the aircraft depending mm-hmm. if it's a busy day. So,
well, what is the cone though? You're talking
it's,
about
it's
the,
just a traffic like a traffic cone.
Oh, okay.
Like an orange cone.
Yeah,
like
right. An orange yeah. with white stripe yeah, or yeah. just orange traffic cone. That we it's that way the person in the other aircraft can focus on that and know, okay, as long as I don't go past that cone, I'll be okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. We do it in the airline world too. We'll use either cones or like an actual barricade.
Yeah.
So we'll set up at the – because like Alex was saying, the wingtips are the widest point in the aircraft. And the nose and the tail are also the widest points.
Yeah.
So after we park it, the ground crew will chalk it, and they'll either pull over the cones and or the barricades. And, you know, if you've got the wingtip, they'll put it just outside of the wingtip so that as people are driving around the airplane to surface it, in theory, as long as they don't hit the barricades or the
so
cones.
So it's like a perimeter.
Like yeah. Exactly, like a perimeter, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
just
fascinating.
A second, a visual representation of the boundaries of the yep. aircraft.
Yeah. Wow. Do they typically do more than the 4 points of aircraft at airlines, or do they actually do like?
It depends on the airplane.
Okay.
I fly a regional jet, a CRJ, so our engines are tail mounted, but a lot of the wing mounted engines, like if you see a 737 or an mm-hmm. Airbus, they'll even put a barricade in front of the engine. And
yeah,
like,
I've seen
the
that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just so that you don't plow into an engine and screw that.
See, I'd be more concerned the other way that someone forgot it and they started that engine and stuck the cone in. Yeah. But that's my way of thinking.
Well, that's actually part of, again, yeah. the importance of ground crews as yep. part of the pre-flight checks. Yep. Because when we're ready to push, we ask the ground crew, okay, parking brake release, confirm you're ready to push.
Yep.
They're supposed to confirm the chocks are out, mm-hmm. all the exterior doors are closed, the baggage doors, the cargo doors, everything else, the fueling door, yep. make sure all the barricades and the cones are removed. So, again, it's a job that does have a lot of importance and responsibility.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Wow, more than I knew.
Oh, yeah. and a lot of this stuff, too, is more of the corporate and airline stuff. But there's parts of this that you can implement to GA. And I'm a firm
absolutely.
Believer
yeah,
of it.
For sure, yeah. Because like you were saying, if you go to some of these mid-sized airports, these regional airports, your Class Charlie airports like Grand Rapids or Lansing or even Pontiac, you know, and you're a GA pilot, well, if you go to some of these larger FBOs, they're going to have those procedures in effect mm-hmm. where You might not be expecting it, but all of a sudden you land and you've got somebody marshaling you in and operating by these procedures because they're just that type of operation.
Oh, yeah.
So it is, like you were saying, you don't have to be well-versed in all, you know, 4 dozen different obscure hand signals, mm-hmm. but you should know the basics.
Yeah.
I'm going to use bad grammar. I wung it. I literally wung it. I think two or three times. Trying to think what airport it was that I went to where they had. I think Ann Arbor had a person with the baton. I just wung it. You know, I guessed, and it turned out to be right.
And most of it's pretty common sense.
Yeah.
So you can kind of, you know, guess right through most of it. We'd encourage that.
I didn't know a lot. Like what Phil was saying, when I went to a different airport one time too, same thing. It's like. I also had the feeling that the guy knew I was like, I didn't know what I was doing. So he's like, okay, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, so let's just help him out. So, but after started working at some of these bigger airports, I did start to learn the hand signals, and they're really helpful. And it's like, but yeah, for the winging part, most GA pilots, I see it time and time again where it's like, okay, he doesn't know what he's doing, so we'll just help him out. And they're pretty good at that. But people got to understand, they're really good at that. So don't feel bad if you don't know, but go in and just review it and, you know, and be familiar with it.
We're really good at telling when people know and don't know. I pick up on it pretty quick normally.
Well, what I would encourage, I mean, there are cheat sheets out there for everything.
Oh, yeah.
I remember when I was working on my private certificate, the light gun signals.
Yes.
You know, so for those who
don't know any of those
light gun signals.
Oh yeah.
the protocol is if you're flying at a towered airport, an airport with a control tower, and you lose two-way radio communications. Well, in theory, you're supposed to comply with these light gun signals. The control tower will take a big spotlight and flash it at you with a variety of colors, and depending on the color and whether or not it's a steady color or a flashing color, that tells you what you're supposed to do.
Yep.
You know, but. When do you use it? How often does your radio fail?
Yeah,
you
don't. Yeah.
And
you never.
And you do the same thing when you're on the ground, because they actually used to use me a lot for because our truck drives on the field the most of any ground vehicle other than the county trucks themselves. And I would get a lot of times they go, "Hey, field truck, are you busy?" I go, "Well, no." They go, "All right, we got a new guy up here. We're going to test some light gun signals."
Yeah.
I go, "Oh, really? Okay." Yeah. And it's the same thing. The aircraft, I would assume you would flash your landing light or taxi light. Mm-hmm. And like we flash our headlights. Yeah. So like, because I have had to use the light gun a couple times where our radio died. So I would always stop and turn my vehicle around so I'm facing the tower, flash some headlights. Even approach, and normally they would flash me, but. Because there's one point you have to cross a runway, and it's like I always stop, I turn, so I face and flash. Because you only cross runaways if you have permission.
Absolutely.
Now they'll go, "Well, you know, you could have just gone." I said, "Nah,
better safe than sorry."
I would rather turn my truck 180, flash you, you flash me, I turn back around and cross the runway.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. And where I was going with that was because they're so obscure and hard to remember because you don't use it every day.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little cheat sheet.
Yeah.
With all the light gun signals on there.
It was on our A-boards, too.
And yeah, it was on our A-boards, what they mean when you're on the air, when you're in the air and on the ground. I'm sure there are guides out there that you can find for the most common handgun signals.
And actually, there's a, in the, I believe it's in the AIM section.
Mm-hmm.
If you, it's actually a good for student pilots and pilots in general. I read it a lot. It has a page on there that does have all the hand signals for ground crews.
Mm-hmm.
So if people want to look at that, then you can find it online. And mm-hmm. but it is in the AIM. I do know that that you can look at it and just you know and approach a ground crew and say, "Hey, you know, let's have a chat. What do you show me?" You know, I mean, anything is. It doesn't have to be. You don't got to take a class or be traditional. Just have it. You know, talk to them. I think they'll be the best to be able to. I've learned a lot from ground crews, whether it's learning how to fuel the airplane. You know. Stack the airplanes and stuff like that. It's good for us to know as general knowledge, even if, you know.
Well, definitely fueling. Definitely fueling. A lot of students don't know how to fuel a
Cessna. That's a whole other topic. Yep.
Yeah.
A lot of students wouldn't be able to go to, a rural airport.
With self-serve.
Oh, yeah.
And self-serve at a fuel farm. They wouldn't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're used to maybe flying out of like, PTK or something like that, where it's done for them already, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that there should be that. Then that brings a good point because even as a flight school, and I do like the idea of what Alex said about talking to ground crews, and I think I'm going to actually start doing it with my students, and actually having them, look at that. I think that's a great idea. I do think that's good.
And if you're ever curious about the self-serve, which I might be jumping topics here.
No, it's fine. Go
like,
ahead.
Most of these FBOs, like us, I mean, I show guys. Like,
yeah,
our,
exactly.
Our base happens to have a self-serve, but our fuel truck is essentially the same thing. You're just not driving a truck. You're using self-serve. So I'll show, you know, I show people all the time. They're like, you know, I'm going to a out-of-airport with a self-serve, and I've never used one before. Can you show me? Of course. We'll gladly do that.
Yep. Well, we do that all the time when we the Dawn Patrol airplane.
Mm-hmm.
We taxi it back to, or we fly it back to Metatol, and then Brian fuels it.
Yeah,
he gets up on the thing and fuels it because he knows how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a lot of pilots. I'm just wondering how many private pilots because
you
know
might
how to cause do
you
it.
Might go somewhere and like get stuck and
realize.
And I have to say, I've had that happen to me before as well. I had to call somebody and know how to use it. Hey, how to use this? I didn't know how to use it, but yeah, so you could get stuck. And but even then, people are going to help you up there. Even if you do get stuck somewhere, generally someone is nice enough to kind of lend a hand. But
yeah,
well, speaking of light signals, real quick, I mean, I cheated one time with that airplane that we used to fly out of, that one FBO.
Okay.
We won't name names, right?
Sure.
And the radio went out. The radio went out when I landed at Pontiac, and I couldn't get a hold of ground control.
Yeah.
So I used my cell phone to call tower, and ground control cleared me on the cell phone to taxi to the pack.
Yes. I've done that, too. Yep. I actually have the tower speed in my speed dial from my phone because there's some times where it's the radio. Your radios die. They have. It happens. It's not. It's nothing to be ashamed or embarrassed about. So it's going to happen eventually to you. It's not if, it's when, just like anything else.
I had a situation that also I was able to help somebody talking to tower on their cell phone and stuff. And the tower was like, are you maintaining, you know, communication with them? I said, oh, yeah, sort of we are. And they're like, okay, well, tell him he's cleared land and so on and so. And that, we helped them out and we were able to do it that way. And it was... You know, I mean, it was safer.
Wasn't the funny thing about that? I know what you're talking about. The funny thing was that he didn't have self-service, so he was texting his wife.
Correct.
And his wife was talking to you on her cell phone, and you're talking to the tower and just trying to establish the communication. Yep. It was pretty entertaining. Yeah,
it was. But we got it done. I mean, that was the main thing.
He was flying from Alaska in a Husky, and his radios quit.
What a potential calamity!
Yes, it was. It was completely.
But we were able to help him out, and you know. Figure all out, and he
made his day.
Yeah, and the tower.
Nervous.
I mean, it was. Let's put it this way: it was much more safer, and the tower I think was appreciative of it, and everybody was kind of happy. So
yeah,
good deal.
You know. One thing too, I forgot to mention about moving aircraft, and this does apply to GA guys with their handbars is tow limits too.
That's what I was just going to talk to you about.
I know. I'm looking at your list. I said I've been on a few podcasts. I know what the there's actually most aircraft, and I say most because there's like two or three aircraft that might not. Like a lot of Lears, some Citations don't have a turn limit. Like you can actually take a nose gear of a Lear and just spin it 360 and go round. They have winter issues with that actually because like if they get into ice and they're trying to turn and they skid, there's a potential that wheel will spin. The whole aircraft kind of goes jerk. And you might the passengers might spill their whiskey, and that you don't want them spilling their drinks.
Yeah.
So,
that's important.
But so a lot of aircraft have a little turn limit, and GA, you know, Piper, Cessnas, Beech, all those have turn limits.
Right.
So you should know your aircraft in that regard. That maybe you have a Mooney, which Moonies are very weird. That they have more turn to the left than they do to the right.
Well, explain what a turn limit is. We're talking about the nose gear.
It's the nose gear. Yes. So the turn limit is the limit that you can you can by hand turn the nose gear, whether you're using a handbar or the tug when you're doing pushback or pulling. There's a certain limit that the wheel can actually turn either left or right, depending on a lot of it depends on the mechanicals. Like I know the shimmy dampener affects some aircraft, and there's a couple other mechanical parts that affect other ones, and I don't remember the exact terms off the top of my head, but you have to pay attention, and most are marked. Now, you might sometimes get these guys that get their planes painted, and the people didn't put them on. That kind of comes to you, as a line guy, asking the pilot, sir, what are the turn limits of your aircraft? They're not marked. And if you don't know, there's always a rule of thumb of you just be very careful. Even if you have to go forward, back to make that turn, you do it because... Yeah. I'd much rather do that than risk breaking a landing gear. Because right. there's certain ones, like a lot of, some of the Pipers, some of the, like the Beechcraft, the Bonanzas and the Barons have very tight turn limits. Cessnas are pretty easy. Cessnas, what's nice is they actually have a solid metal pieces on the nose gear, so you can't. Although I did see a guy force a plane, a 172, so hard because the wheel was stuck in a crack and he was not paying attention. They actually crunched and crushed the metal part of the strut.
Oh, wow.
Where
wow.
the turn limit goes. Yeah. He actually crushed that. Oh, and, you know, $5,000 later and he's fired. Because you only get, well, you get one and then after that you're done.
So as a service technician, you get one strike.
You get one strike.
Okay.
And you, I mean, and granted, it's a time frame. If you have one, 5 years later you have another one, fine. Because it's all about being cautious, being careful, and taking things slow.
Right.
You're hurrying, you're doing something, you just shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And if you're taking things slow and cautiously, nothing should happen. I'm doing air quotes here. Should
right.
happen. Because yeah. I have had things, weird things happen, moving aircraft, and all of a sudden the tire just goes flat, and the nose, or something drops, and this happens, and this happens, and you don't know what's going on. You also, just stop.
Also, I think, also in the wintertime as well, operations are a little more difficult.
Yes.
I imagine
yeah.
as well.
Because yeah,
I've
you were going to get to that. Ice. Yeah,
the icing is always interesting because that's another whole, you know, I've seen some things, and it puts a lot more pressure.
So majority of the weight on aircraft is the main gears. So that's where the weight is. So a lot of times nose gears are very light. So what will happen a lot of times is when you're pushing or pulling usually it's pushing an aircraft and you're going through snow issues or icing and you start turning, that nose gear can all of a sudden just go on its own, catch the ice and just go. And if your tug's on ice or whatever, it'll pivot.
Right.
That nose gear wants to just swing out. It's so light. And a lot of Citations and Learjets are really bad at that because they're very nose light. And I've seen where they hit a bad rut in the blacktop when you're pushing a Lear, and the nose gear actually comes up and the tire came off the ground a couple inches and then came down gently.
Oh, wow.
Thankfully gently because you catch the tug right and you just kind of let it do its thing. But you got to be very careful, especially wintertime. When you're pushing, you treat it like it's very tight turn limit because the harder you try to turn and the sharper, mm-hmm. the more potential that the nose is just going to swing and go, and the main gear that you're trying to pivot on just goes with it. So that way the whole aircraft tries to turn away from you. Hmm. And then
all of a sudden you're in a battle.
You're in a battle. You are in a
battle.
I can give you an airline perspective, two stories, one related to snow and ice and another one related to turn limits. So with snow and ice, our procedure for the airline is actually if we're pushing back on a contaminated ramp or taxiway, we actually can't start the engines until the pushback is complete. Reason being, the aircraft is large. We can weigh as much as 85,000 pounds in my aircraft when we're pushing back. And we've got one tug pushing us. And typically, obviously, the tugs that push us are powerful enough to move the airplane. But if you got snow and ice on a ramp, if you're trying to push this airplane back on ice with less traction, it could cause problems. And our jet engines, even at idle thrust, are powerful enough so where if you're pushing this airplane back and we start one engine at a time, well, the asymmetric thrust from when you start one engine over the other could cause the airplane to yaw to one side or another.
Yep.
Or just the thrust from the engine, the idle thrust could be enough to when you already have reduced traction on ice anyway, now the tractor is not only fighting against the weight of the airplane, but also the thrust from the engine to where it can't push the airplane back. You know, so we have to actually wait just to be safe until the pushback is complete, everything's removed, the tow bar is removed and everything, and the tug is disconnected, and then start our engines when we're taxiing or something when we're pushing back on.
So there's a funny story I'm going to add. I know you had another one, but on
go ahead.
So Hawkers, like 700, 800s, have the APU blast that blows straight out the back of the tail.
Yeah.
And we had a Hawker stuck. I mean, it was stuck because the wheels were warm when it landed, came in, it sat, and then it got just stuck in ruts of snow and ice.
Okay.
And when they had their APU running, and we couldn't get this thing to move at all. And typically, tugs push better than they pull, typically. And finally, I go, you know what? Shut the APU off. And look at me and said, just shut it off. They shut it off. And I started going, and it finally started pushing. I didn't think an APU exhaust could do that.
Yeah.
And I've never seen it since. I still think it was a very series of unfortunate events that caused that. I think it was just the right amount of whatever happening going on, the exhaust blast and stuff. Because APUs don't generally push out a lot, not like a jet engine.
No.
But
they're much smaller.
Oh, much. But yeah. And so I've always, since then, I've always been very cautious of, even like when you get the Challengers and the Gulfstreams that blow out to the side, I've always been very cautious of, okay, this APU is going, so I'm going to be very cautious about this.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it can definitely make a difference.
Yeah.
So the other one is, again, the airplane I fly, we have hydraulic assist with the steering, kind of like power steering in your car, whereas a lot of GA airplanes, your typical Cessnas, Pipers, Moonies, it's all pilot manual steering. You press the rudder pedal that actually is linked to the nose gear to move the nose gear manually. You don't have any power assist.
Yeah.
So we've got two steering modes. One is precast steering, and the other one is called nose wheel steering. When the airplane's being pushed back, we've got it in precast steering mode because we want to give the control to the tug operator to be able to maneuver the airplane however he or she needs to move it. And then once we're pushed back and we do all of our after start checklists and pushback checklists, then we engage nose wheel steering. So that way when you move the rudders, or in this case, actually the tiller, rudders or the tiller, either one, it actually steers the nose gear where you want it to go, more like a car. Well, again, it's important to pay attention and not just say, oh, we're just moving on the ground. It's no big deal.
Right.
Because we have had pilots. This isn't me. This is other people at our company. But it could happen to anybody, of course.
Sure.
So I try not to get complacent. But we've had pilots accidentally leave that nose wheel steering switch engaged after we park.
Oh.
So then you hook up the tug with the tow bar. And then if the pilot gets in and maybe adjusts his or her seat and actually goes to maybe move the rudder, you've got 3,000 pounds of hydraulic pressure steering that nose gear. And we've actually swung a tug around on the ground and sheared off a tow bar because we've got hydraulic steering engaged.
I can imagine someone sitting in that.
And that's actually an interesting fact that a lot of tow bars have a shear pin for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So that way that pin gives, so at least the bar head separates from the bar and potentially, hopefully you don't damage anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so
potentially,
it's designed.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, yes. A lot of the Gulfstream bar heads do that. A lot of them have a shear pin because how they connect in. So that way, a lot of the Gulfstreams, like the 280s, the 4, 5, 6, they're all like just like what you were saying your airlines are, is the hydraulic assist steering.
Mm-hmm.
And so that way if something happened where it – like it's basically the same situation you said.
Yeah.
And that way it'll shear the head of the bar off and won't damage the aircraft, or shouldn't, and won't kill someone, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really shouldn't even say hydraulic assist. To be more precise, it's just complete hydraulic steering.
Yeah.
I mean, when you press the rudder pedal, it's sending – it's not – there's no manual connection. It's all hydraulic fluid being sent to the actuators to move the nose gear. But still, same thing. I just wanted to be a little more precise.
I can listen to you two all day.
Yeah,
this is great.
Oh yeah,
this is going back.
Oh yeah, well,
it was knowledge.
And I don't work at a commercial field, so there's lots of I've never experienced, and that's kind of neat to hear some of the things on your end, Brian, because I've never dealt with 737s. The biggest things I've dealt with are DC-9s, and those things are just I'm unloading freight, so there's not a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Or trying to understand, because I don't know Spanish, trying to understand Spanish as they're trying to tell me how to do the fueling operation. Because every single DC-9 from Mexico has got a different fueling procedure.
Yeah.
Every single one.
Imperial gallons or whatnot. Mm. And,
or they have a goofy fitting that they have a custom head for. Mm-hmm. Or you have to do this switch, and then wait. And then when it hits this certain thing, then you do this switch and turn this switch off. I've dealt with it. Oh, it's the weirdest stuff.
Are you working your way towards the airline, like, you know, major airport?
No. I want to stay away from that. Yeah. I want to stay far away from that.
Yeah. You talked about briefly about gear collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about that. And I know that most gears, nose gears,
swing under. Yes, yeah, so they swing back towards the fuselage. So, what's off the top of my head is back to some of the Gulfstreams and the Challengers. They have landing gear pins.
Okay.
So when ground operations are moving the aircraft, they have a physical big fat pin that they shove into the landing gear because a lot of them are hydraulically powered or boosted or assisted, whatever word you want to use for it. When that's off, there's the potential that if the pressure were to bleed off, like maybe there's a leak in the system and you jerk the aircraft around hard, there's a potential a gear could collapse in. So a lot of these aircraft have a manual pin that they put into the aircraft. Most of them are only the main, some are also the nose. And this ensures that that way, if that pressure bleeds off, you're not going to collapse the gear.
Okay.
And with the nose pins, a lot of times they do the nose pin because when you're pushing an aircraft, most of them fold in towards the fuselage, so backwards. Right. And most of the time we're pushing the aircraft, so because that's the easiest way to move them. So that also ensures that the tug, we're pushing it, we're not forcing. Like maybe they left the parking brake on and someone just gets in the tug, goes with it, and it doesn't go. And that way you're not potentially collapsing the nose gear of the aircraft.
Right.
That's kind of where, like, when I approach an aircraft with a tug, first thing I do is I put it into the gear and I just let off the gas pedal or the brake pedal. And the idle running in gear should roll the aircraft lightly. If it doesn't, there's probably a parking brake on. I stop. I go find the pilot. If I can't find the pilot, I'm familiar with some aircraft. I'll go in and check the parking brake. Like Hawker pilots, I don't know why they always leave the parking brakes on me. Always. So I'm very familiar with Hawker parking brakes. Go in there, pop the lever, pop the aircraft shifts. Okay, we're good. Keep going. But that way, you're not going to risk collapsing gear because there's some aircraft too. I think it's like some of the Cessna, I think the 421s, 420s, 414s, I believe their nose gear actually folds forward. So that potential is when you're pulling the aircraft, you could potentially collapse it in. And those don't have any type of pin. So, I mean, if you wrenched and jerked on it, you could collapse the nose gear. I know a 421, all there is this rod that's like this. And
wow,
if you jerk it and it bounces and goes like that,
you're
that,
in trouble.
That gear's down. It's done. Because that killed, because there was a guy at the airport that had a 320, and he was under his aircraft doing something, and he bumped that, and it.
Ouch. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I can definitely back you up. Just for reference, the CRJ is a little unusual because, like you said, the 421s have the forward swinging nose gear, so they retract forward on takeoff. The CRJ is the same way. So we've got the nose gear, and we've got what's called the drag brace. So for those of you who don't know a drag brace, when you see the gear come down, there's also a little piece of metal. It kind of makes like a triangular shape, usually on most aircraft. And if you can think about like extending your elbow all the way out until it locks, or maybe if you lock your legs fully back so that, you know, it's locked at the knee to give it more stability, the drag brace, when it extends, it locks into position in an over center position. So it basically, it's hydraulically supported. So it's backed up by hydraulic pressure. It's not supposed to move, but also the simple mechanical position of how the gear is constructed, it's supposed to fight against gravity and prevent the gear from retracting. So we have that, but we also have gear pins as well. So when the gear is fully extended, you extend the pin in through the gear, and it's supposed to keep all components of the gear in their proper orientation so that the gear can't fold back up. You know, it's kind of like if you can picture opening your door and then maybe it's like sticking like a pencil in between the door and the door jamb. So it's like, well, if the pencil's there, you can't close your door now because the pencil's physically blocking
it. So those are like safety mechanisms.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's actually something that we're looking for on our pre-flight inspection in the airlines. We're looking to see, normally we store the gear pins actually in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. So when I get in the airplane and I'm doing my interior inspection inside, we're checking everything. We're checking the oxygen mask. We're checking the aircraft systems. And also behind the first officer's seat, we've got four pins. One for each main gear, one for the nose gear, and then we also have a ram air turbine so that if we lose all electrical power, this ram air turbine extends. It's basically like an air-driven generator.
It's like a fan. Wow. Right?
Like a fan, yeah, that will provide us electrical power. Yep. But there's also a pin for that. Now, if they're doing maintenance on the aircraft or towing the aircraft on the ground, they stick the gear pins in for the reasons just like you said, you know.
Because most of these aircraft are 30-plus years old. How great is the systems? Do they actually hold? I mean.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. But obviously, when we're flying, we don't want the pins in because otherwise the gear aren't going to retract.
Right.
Yes.
Or if we do need the ram air turbine to extend and the pins in, then we're going to be screwed, you know, with no electrical power.
And that's why all those pins and your pedo covers and everything have those flags that say remove before flight.
Yeah.
Because I've had it where people come in with their, you know, with a Challenger and they put their pins in, and there's no flags. And I'm like, oh, I don't like that at all. So I'll go inside. I'll grab some of the pink ribbon and I'll tie the ribbon on their pins because you don't. Yeah. I've actually had a Hawker taxi away from us with their pistol in because the pilot said, oh, we're good. We'll get it. I go, are you sure? Oh, we're good. Well, Hawker pilots, they just start taxiing away. And I grab the radio. I say, ground, the Hawker. They left their landing gear, their pins in. And they stopped. Pilot got out, got the pins. So
were they mad? I'm just
no, they didn't say anything.
And that also goes for students too. When you're doing a pre-flight as well, make sure you if there's any covers or stuff like that, or make sure you remove all that stuff as well.
Yeah,
and that's also
cowl plugs.
Yeah, that too. Yeah,
we've had students go, we're getting some high temp here. What is going on here? Cowl plugs. Wintertime's the worst. Wintertime's the worst. And they do that.
Yeah.
It's not like the garbage trucks or your old big vans where you just shove cardboard in front of the radiator because you want that heat. No. Yeah. Now the airplanes. No.
We'll talk about fueling real quick here.
Sure.
Then I want to go to Tannis Eaters. So as we discussed that real quick because there's some student pilots that are listening.
Yeah.
Fueling airplanes. Okay. Now let's say we have a Cessna 172 pulling up.
170 poo, I like that.
A 170 poo pulling up. And,
it's a new one.
Yeah, it's a new Cessna. It's a little more advanced than 172. So
flies like crap, though.
Yeah.
That's good. That's right.
I was waiting for someone to make that comment.
So say we're taxiing up, and I say to you, well, we're at quarter tanks. We got four people. We're going to have added weight to this airplane in a few minutes. So just fill it to half tanks.
No. I'm gonna say it is your responsibility to know what you want in the aircraft. I cannot see most aircraft. I can't tell from the exterior of what is in that tank. Other than when you get into some of the like the Lances, some of the Barons have an external gauge. Then yes, I can do that. I can go okay and judge it. But when as a line service person, tech, whatever you want to call me, I should be told specific gallons. You should figure out what you want. And if you don't know, say, okay, start with 8. I'll put 8 in, and then I'll step away. You can step up the aircraft and see and with your gauge go, no, I need 2 more gallons. Okay. You can't just tell me, fill it to this. Unless there's a physical representation, like some aircraft, the Cirruses have a tab in them. Some of the Piper, the Dakotas and stuff have a tab in them.
Okay.
You can say 2 tabs or do tabs plus 5 gallons. Then yeah. I can do that. But if we're going to use 172 as an example, there is no exterior way to tell how much fuel is in
there. How much fuel you're putting in.
So the pilot should have their little stick that they dip in there, put the finger on top and pick it up and it's to tell them what the gallons are. So they go, okay, put 4 gallons of side in.
Right.
Or maybe 4 gallons on this side and 5 on that side. Or
yeah, it's up to the pilot.
Yeah, because
to do the calculation.
Because if I just fuel it anyway, the fueling's on me. It's my responsibility. So, and if I mess up and the pilot goes, well, you put too much fuel in, that is a misfuel on my end. I misfueled your aircraft.
Really?
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, potentially, depending where you work, you can get in trouble for that because that's an error. That is an error. You made an error. It's the putting the wrong amount of fuel in an aircraft is to some places the equivalent of putting the wrong fuel in the aircraft because it's either way, it's just as deadly. If someone plans it wrong.
And
either way,
it's overweight.
Yeah, it could be just like you said, it could be deadly either way. Yeah. If I'm a pilot and I'm planning a flight based on a certain amount of fuel, if I don't have enough fuel, well, then I'm potentially putting myself at risk of running out of fuel. And if I have too much fuel, well, maybe I'm planning to get out of a short field on a hot day at a high density altitude, and I'm planning my takeoff at a given weight, and I've got extra fuel that I don't expect, well, then my performance can be compromised as well, you know.
Time.
So.
Yeah. So we want numbers. We want actual numbers, or if you have an aircraft with tabs, you can say the tab plus a certain amount of gallons, or we need something that we can use our eyes with and see, because we can't see into those tanks. 172s are near impossible to see in there.
I know.
And the instructor in me saying also to mention as well for any student pilots listening, it's a very important habit to get into, just like you said, taking a dipstick and actually putting the dipstick in the tank and checking the actual fuel level. Always physically and visually verify how much fuel you have on board, because just like you said, these tanks are, there's a little opening to fuel it up. It's kind of similar to your car. You know, you can't imagine gassing up your car at the gas station and looking inside that little hole to be able to see how much is in there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you really don't know. And with cars, it's not as big of a deal because you're on the ground, number one.
Right. Yep.
And number two, the fuel technology in cars has advanced a lot. your typical small general aviation airplane is actually using, it's called capacitance probe technology. It was made back in the 1930s.
Yeah. So, okay. No, typically, airplanes are running on the.
I've never heard of that before.
Yeah. Look up capacitance probe fueling technology.
Wow.
I've never heard that. That's I just say basically an airplane, like a 172, you're driving a like a 58
yeah.
Buick.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
that's...
In a nutshell, basically it means that the fuel tanks are not the most reliable.
Yeah. Right. You never want to trust the fuel gauges either.
You never look at the fuel gauges in the airplane and bet your life on those. Yeah. You can get an idea to say, okay, well, around half or around three quarters or whatever.
Either.
But you always want to actually.
And you don't have to have the fancy tubes either. A lot of guys just go to Home Depot and
you can just mark your own.
And you top it. They mark it on their paint stick and then they fly it for a while and then mark it up and then they know what they have. I mean,
also, it's talking about just about fuel. When you talk about being the pilot as a student, also get them in the habit of like checking the fuel and stuff like that, and just do it every time, every day, every flight, I should say.
Okay, so about fueling. So that's the big thing there. Did you want to touch on self-serve a little bit?
Well, the student pilots, you know, we in the wintertime. We're often pilots in general for GA airplanes, 172 Cessnas. We have to plug them in.
Yeah.
Okay. Explain to the audience, especially student pilots that are listening, why do we plug those airplanes in when it's cold, and what does that do?
So that plug you're plugging in, the brand name is a Tanis heater. Everyone calls them Tanis heaters. They're actually a block heater, and what that is it's a magnetic block that a lot of places also glue on just so it doesn't come off onto the block of the engine. And when you plug that in, it's putting current through, which helps warm the block, warms the oil, warms everything around in there. Even like in good ones, even warm the whole inside of the cowling up really good and toasty. And then that way you have an easier start in the wintertime, because when an aircraft, just like a car, when they sit, the first several seconds, 30, even 30 seconds of runtime, they're running dry, no oil.
Right.
So the oil has to take time to build up. So the thinner the oil, the quicker it gets through all the passages and starts lubricating everything.
So you want to keep it warm.
You want to keep it warm. You want to see that way the oil's thinner, viscosity's down, and it can actually get to everything it needs to get to.
So it keeps the entire block warm.
Yeah.
Like the almost the entire engine.
Yeah.
The good one.
So one last question for you.
Okay.
If we have some even student pilots who want to work at an airport and do like line service technician, what is your suggestion to them?
Approach the FBO. Say, hey, are you looking for any line guys? I mean, that's how I started. I heard from word of mouth this guy's looking for a line guy. So I walked the field. I walked in the building. I said, is the boss around? They pointed out the ramp. I walked out the ramp. He's moving a sheriff helicopter. I say, are you looking for a guy? Yeah. So I worked with him for 2 hours, helping him move aircraft and do stuff. And at the end of it, he said, when do you want to start?
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's easy.
You'd start and then you get your experience as you work.
Yeah, that's what it is. The easy stuff is fueling. Then you move to moving the aircraft and customer service stuff, things like that.
Good deal.
Yeah.
Well, Alex, we were glad to have you on the show.
Yeah.
And anytime you want to come back, please do.
Yeah, because there's a bit I'd like to talk about.
I have
about.
A feeling we only covered maybe a quarter of the information.
It could be more than that. Yeah.
I'd like to talk about the self-serve fueling stuff, the safety with that, but I understand we're running out of time. So.
Okay. But we're going to keep that in mind for another show, and we'll have you on. You want to do the closing?
Before you do the closing, I just wanted to add one thing.
Baz, you do the closing.
You guys can do the closing, but
we'll leave it to you.
There's a change in the flight plans now. It has just officially changed to the international flight plan now. It has to be all used. Are you guys all familiar with
that? No.
Okay, so that's something
I'm old.
So that has been taken effect. So people should just look at that. You know, look at that format. It's the
international flight planning.
Everything's ICAO
standard.
International Civil Aviation.
So when you do your flight plan, it's all on a standard.
ICAO
for that.
Or IKEA?
ICAO.
ICAO. ICAO.
Oh. It's kind of a mess because you've got almost 150 countries that are coming together to create this flight plan form that everybody's satisfied with. So it's not as user-friendly as the old domestic FAA flight plan form, but
That's why I'm telling first people to start looking at that and just, you know.
How does that fit in with 4Flight?
Four Flight will plan it for you automatically.
I'm just so way behind on the times.
Yeah, so.
And for this episode of PyReps, I'm Private Pilot Phil, and for Alex and Ground Instructor Bazzi and First Officer Brian Johnson, have a good night, folks.
We'll see you next time.
See you.
See you.